Side 8, Pearls of Lutra by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 350. The squirrel maid thought for a moment, then recalled the lines. See if you can find the right hip. Turn west, and you're halfway there. Picking up the dead bee, Rollo seated himself on the stool. Halfway there. I knew it. Hermald the Ancient isn't giving up the last pearl so lightly to us. This pitiful dead thing is only half the clue. We've solved the first part by getting this far, and an old dead bee is the second part. When we've found what it means, the last pearl will be ours. Tansy almost danced with irritation.
But there's nothing with it. No parchment or poem.
Nothing except a silly old thing that was once a bee, though goodness knows how many seasons ago. As they walked back into Great Hall, Cracklin had an idea.
Maybe it's something beginning with the letter B.
Rollo gazed around the moon-shadowed hall and yawned.
How about bed? That begins with B. I'm tired.
Tansy took the dead insect from him.
Oh, that's brilliant, sir, she said, her voice echoing angrily. Brilliant begins with B, too. And breakfast, and bath, and badger, and...
Cracklin took hold of Tansy's paw gently.
And bad-tempered beast.
Rollo's right. It's late, and we're all tired. Come on, pal. Time you were in bed. We'll see if we can sort this thing out tomorrow. Shamefacedly, Tansy passed the dead bee back to Rollo.
I'm sorry, sir. It's not your fault we only found a bee. Forgive me.
The old recorder leaned heavily against her, chuckling.
I'm not bothered by bees, but ready to do battle with blankets, my friend. Carry me upstairs.
Tansy shook him off playfully.
You're getting far too old to go upstairs. We'll have to get Perlo's stump to make you a little barrel bed down here.
With surprising agility for one of his seasons, Rollo hitched up his robe and scampered off up the stairs, cackling,
Too old, am I? Well, last one up is a frazzled frog, hee-hee-hee.
3 hours after dawn the next morning, birdsong echoed from the abbey's inner walls. White clouds flecked a cheery blue sky, and the treetops of mossflower wood rippled in a light, fragrant breeze. Tansy was still asleep in her bed when she was set upon and attacked by Dibbons.
Come on, missy, wakey hop, girt Puddin'-Ed. Still asleepin' her.
Struggling awake, she tried to fight back, but Arvin buffeted her soundly with a pillow.
Tansy, pansy, toogle-doo. Sleep all a day, and you get no breakfast.
Kicking off two mole babes, who were tickling her footpaws, the hedgehog maid succeeded in capturing Arvin and rolling him in a blanket.
"Leave me alone, you little maggot. I was up very late last night, and I need my sleep. Now go on, be off with you."
Diggum waved her digging claws under Tansy's nose.
"Her, he must get out of ye bed right now, or Friar Eagle says he given your breakfast to a girt owly bird, so there."
Tansy leapt out, dashing water from a basin onto her face and wiping it with a towel.
No breakfast of mine is going to be scoffed by Gerald the Glutton. Out of my way, I need food.
Chuckling and giggling uproariously, the Dibbons pursued her downstairs to where Rollo and Cracklin sat, halfway through their morning meal. Cracklin indicated a seat.
Over there, Tansy. There's oat bread, raspberry preserve, strawberry cordial, too. I know that's your favorite breakfast.
Tansy sat down between her friends, panting.
The Dibbons said Friar Higgle was going to give my breakfast to Garrel, so I got down as fast as I could.
Arvin vaulted onto the tabletop, pointing at Cracklin.
She told us to say dat. Friar never said nothink.
Cracklin ducked as Tansy's wooden spoon narrowly missed her.
Well, we had to get you out of bed somehow, or you'd have snored until supper.
Tansy spread raspberry preserve and a warm oat cake.
Well, Rollo, any more news of our dead bee? It didn't get up and fly off during the night, did it?
The bank vole polished his glasses on the tablecloth.
Very droll indeed, young maid.
We were about to take it to one who might help us, Brother Dormaw. No beast in Redwall has a knowledge of plants and insects like the good brother. Gulping down her drink and spreading another oatcake with preserve, Tansy quitted the table.
Good idea. Come on. What are we waiting for?
Dormaw was out in the orchard with Garrel, explaining the finer points of a red currant hedge to the owl as the three friends walked up. Rollo held out the dead bee on the flat of his paw.
Dormaw, old friend, what do you make of this?
Oh, dear. A vagrant breeze caught the feather-like bee husk and swept it up into the air. Cracklin cried out,
Stop that bee! It shouldn't be flying, it's dead!
They watched it being swept up almost above the height of a well-grown apple tree. Tansy dashed about on the ground with her paws outstretched, ready to catch the bee if the wind dropped.
If it gets lost, we'll never find the sixth pearl, she cried. Oh, please, some beast, do something!
Garrel flapped his wings experimentally, did an awkward hop-skipping run, and leapt into the air, flapping. He hovered for seconds, swaying on the breeze, then spread his awesome wings and soared upward, flapping them slowly. Below, they watched open-mouthed as the owl swept round in a great wheeling arc and expertly picked the bee out of mid-air with his beak. In a trice, he was back on the grass, depositing the bee in Tansy's outstretched paw. She smiled and shook her head.
You feathery old fraud! Your wings were supposed to be far too badly injured for you ever to fly again.
Plucking a red currant from the hedge, Garrel chewed thoughtfully.
You're right, missy. You ain't wrong. Sure, and I thought the same thing myself till just a moment ago. I didn't know I could still fly. Then I saw you all so upset over losing your bee, and I was in the air flying before I could stop myself, so I was.
Brother Dormaw scratched his nose to hide a smile.
No doubt your old mother would have had something to say about it all, had she been here, of course.
Garrel crammed several more red currants into his beak.
You're right, Sir Brother. So she would. I remember when I was a chick fresh out of the egg, my old mother used to say, You'll never fly till you try. And if you're never try, you'll never fly. So try and fly, and you'll find out why. It's good to try and nice to fly.
Tansy shook Garrel's taloned claw energetically.
And never a truer word was spoken. Well done, sir.
Brother Dormaw listened as they told him how they had come to find the bee. He inspected the body closely and said,
Hum, 'tis just a long-dead bee, friends. How am I supposed to help you?
Cracklin curtsied prettily, playing up to the good brother by flattering him.
It was me, brother. I said, let's go and ask Brother Dormaw. Of all Redwallers, his knowledge of plants and insects is the greatest by far.
Brother Dormaw is a clever and educated creature, I said.
Dormaw smiled, pleased but slightly embarrassed by the compliment.
Ahem. Thank you, young maid. Hum. Let me think. Perhaps while I'm mulling the problem over, you could stop that owl bolting all my red currants, or he'll make himself too heavy to fly again.
Garrel was shooed from the orchard, complaining loudly.
Ah, faith and seasons! 'Tis a bitter day when a poor bird tries to help friends, and they reward him by starving the wretched creature. And after me wearing me old wings to the bone, catching dead bees for you. Shame on you all. Sure, I'll take myself off to the kitchens and tell my good mate Ma Teasel about it. No doubt she'll toss me a few old candied chestnuts to keep beak and feathers together. Oh, 'tis a hard, cruel abbey I'm living in.
He ambled off doing small practice flights, followed by the three friends' laughter. Dormaw took a piece of blackberry creeper vine, wound the dead bee in it, so that it would not blow away again, and gave it to Cracklin.
My thoughts on this are very simple. Everything in its place, and a place for everything. For instance, if I had a dead fish, I would immediately think of the pond. A cracked egg, the nest. An empty acorn cup, the oak tree. Any object originates from somewhere. So, if you present me with a dead bee, straight away one word springs to mind. Hive.
Rollo slapped a paw hard against his own forehead.
Of course, the hive! You make things seem so simple with your straightforward logic, Dormaw. How can we ever thank you?
The good brother smiled shyly.
Oh, I have a feeling you won't be thanking me yet. At least, not until I have discovered which beehive your pearl is hidden in. After all, I am the Abbey Beekeeper, an unofficial title which I share with our cellar hog, Furlough Stump. Actually, I think our friends the bee folk like Furlough the best. He has a way with them. Let's go and ask him.
50. Furlough Stump and Formole were in the wine cellars, their tabletop a barrel head, and their seats small kegs. The sturdy cellar-keeper was always glad of company.
"Come ye in, friends. We'd be beholden for your advice."
Tansy glanced at the array of food on the barrel-head table. "They say fair exchange is no robbery, sir, and we've come for your advice on a matter of importance."
Formole moved the kegs apart and placed a plank between them, making a seat for all to sit upon.
"Your mates bain't nothing so important as vittles. Ewan's help us'ns first."
Dormal sat willingly, eyeing the food.
"Certainly. What do you want us to do?"
Furlough brought out extra plates, beakers, and knives. "We're a-tasting cheeses against drinks to go with 'em. Now, here's dandelion and burdock cordial, October ale, strawberry fizz, elderberry wine, mint tea, and plum and dansom cup. The cheeses are to be matched with 'em. There's the big yellow with chestnut and celery, a white with hazelnuts in it, that pale gold with chives and apple, and the soft cream with almonds. Anyhow, there's a few others that you know. So take a nibble and a sip of anything suits your fancy, and give us an opinion." They all set about the delightful task with a will.
"Ooh, the soft cream and almond tastes lovely with strawberry fizz. Hurr! There bain't nothing like Tober ale, any girt yellerin, with chestnutters and celery, boy oaky there bain't."
"Yes, I'm inclined to agree with you, Formole. But this one over here, the fawn-colored one with carrot and acorn in it, now that really goes well with mint tea. Try it. I like the plum and damson cup, with chive and apple cheese. What's that one you've got, Tansy?"
"It's a sort of solid, ready one, with radish and onion in it. It tastes marvelous with a sip of dandelion and burdock cordial."
The tasting went on at length. Ever the recorder, Rollo had been jotting down notes on a length of bark parchment as he sipped and nibbled, taking heed of their opinions with his own choice. When they were finished, Rollo gave the parchment to Furlough.
"I've written it all down here, friend, which cheeses are matched with each drink by popular agreement."
Furlough Stump accepted the list gratefully.
"Thank ye all. Now, when there's a feast, I only have to glance at Teasel and my brother Iggle's menu, and I knows which drinks to serve. You don't know how much of an help this'll be to us."
Formole nodded his velvety head in agreement.
"Brr, aye, zers and missies. 'Twill save a lot of rushing about oop and downy stairs on our old paws, hur, hur."
Furlough cleared his barrel-top table.
"Now, what service can I render you good beasts in return?"
Sitting in respectful silence, they watched the stout hedgehog move the dead bee this way and that, peering closely at it. He made small tutting noises as he turned the object back and forth on the tabletop, shaking his head.
"This ain't one of our bees," he said. "We have good old honeybees at Redwall. They don't carry as much fuzz on 'em as this feller."
Brother Dormall nodded in agreement.
"Aye, that's what I thought, Furlough. Perhaps it's a red-tailed bumblebee. What do you think?"
Furlough picked the bee up and brought it close to his eyes.
"Red-tailed bumblebee, eh? Well, you could be forgiven for thinking that, brother. But this'n ain't no red tail, though it looks like one. I only ever seen a few of these in my seasons. This is a mason bee. Quite a rare insect in these parts."
Cracklin looked at the carcass questioningly.
"A mason bee? What sort of hive does that live in?"
Furlough warmed to his subject.
"Mason bees don't have a hive, missy. They're solitary creatures. They'll burrow into the side of a wall, twixt the gaps in stones where the mortar's gone soft. Sometimes they'll do it in solid sand, like the dry side of a river bank,
though walls is mainly their favorite place. The male and female roots out a single space, and there they leave one egg with honey and nectar to feed the young when it hatches. They seal the nest with mud and go off to build the next one. Rollo threw up his paws in despair. So we're not looking for a hive, just a crack in a wall. This is a big abbey with lots of stonework. It could be anywhere. Furlow took off his work apron and patted Rollo's paw. Don't look so downhearted, sir. There's six of us altogether, and me and Formal will help you look. 'Tis the least we could do. Geralt came hopping in, picking crumbs from his feathers. Good day to you. The old Friar Higgle says that there's some food testin' to be done down here, so I thought I'd be brave and volunteer my services, so I did. Formal waved a digging cloth and drinks and cheeses.
Her, sir, we am already done it. But there's e vittles if an e'd like to try.
The owl's eyes widened with pleasure. Ah, well, 'twill be a terrible task, but I'll do me best. You good beasts be off about your business now. I'll give you the results of my labors at supper tonight, so I will.
Grinning and winking at one another, they quit the cellars. Tansy stood at the center of the abbey lawn with the search party, her eyes roving about to and fro.
Where to begin? Any beast got a helpful suggestion? She asked.
Formal came up with a scheme immediately.
Oh, aye, miss. You comin' with Furlow and I. Us in searchy walls. Miss Cracklin, e go with Rollo and Dormal. You uns look round the abbey building. That ways, both parties do have one young set of eyes to help.
It was a good suggestion. The two parties went off to their allotted places and began searching. Afternoon shades were lengthening toward evening, when Rollo sat down against the East Abbey wall and polished his spectacles wearily.
My old eyes are dizzy from looking. Searching for a mason bee nest may sound simple, but it's definitely not.
Tansy and her party were halfway round the west wall, having just passed the gatehouse, working toward the south wall, and they were becoming equally dispirited. Sitting on the steps by the gatehouse, they took a brief rest. The hedgehog maid glanced up to see Sister Cicely approaching with a stern face, and said, "Oh, dear, here comes trouble. I wonder what the sister wants." Folding her paws into her habit sleeves, Cicely pursed her lips and tapped her footpaw, the picture of righteous anxiety.
"It's those three dibbins again, missing. Take my word, 'tis not the seasons graying my fur or aging my bones. It's that villain Arvin and those two mole babes who follow him anywhere."
Tansy tried hard to keep her patience with the persnickety mouse.
"I'm sure they've not gone far, sister," she reassured Cicely firmly. "We're very busy here with a most important task. But if we see them, I'll let you know right away."
Cicely stood for a moment, gnawing her bottom lip. Then she turned abruptly and swept off, muttering,
"If I find them in the usual state, smocks torn, filthy and dirty, scratched and bruised, they'd better watch out."
Furlow pulled a face at Tansy and winked.
"That un's a good old mouse in lots of ways, but her temper don't improve with age. I wouldn't like to be those dibbins when she finds them, miss."
Tansy watched Sister Cicely flounce into the abbey.
"I agree with you, sir. Sometimes I think her main purpose in life is chasing after Arvin and the mole babes, though half the time they're not missing, just playing somewhere. Matter of fact, I know where they are right now, though I didn't tell the sister, because she'd only send them off to bed early."
Formal chuckled, his small round eyes twinkling.
"Where do we little rascals be, missy?"
Tansy nodded in the direction of the east wall corner.
"Over there behind the bushes. They've been hiding there all afternoon. I can see the bushes shaking from here. Come on, let's take a walk across and see what they're up to."
Arvin, Diggum, and Gerbil were prancing about in a den they had built among the bushes. They squeaked in dismay as Furlow Stump's strong spiked head poked through into their lair. The kindly hedgehog grinned at the abbey babes.
"Now then, you little maggots, what are you doing in here?"
Arvin held a tiny paw to his lips and whispered furtively,
"Us hidin' from Sissy Cicely." and dance in bees' dances. Don't you tell her, or she chop a tails off us."
Tansy and Formal joined the Dibbons, and they all sat down together in the cool green shade. Tansy narrowed her eyes at Arvin fiercely, but he knew she was only joking.
"Tansy Pansy, we do's a bees' dance for you," he said.
Trying hard not to burst out laughing, the searchers watched the three Dibbons go into their dance, whirring their paws and weaving circles about each other, stopping now and then to stab the air with their tails as they made bee noises.
"Fizz-bizz, busy-buzz, fizz-bizz, fizz-buzz."
Gerbil and Diggum buzzed on either side of Arvin, who had appointed himself chief bee. They held the bushes aside, and he danced his way in between them, fuzzing and buzzing comically. Then they let the bushes fall back into place and buzzed aloud as they poked at the air with stubby tails, awaiting his emergence. Suddenly Arvin leapt from the bushes, all three buzzed once and bowed, and the dance was over. Their audience applauded, and Furlow stroked Arvin's head approvingly.
"Well done, mate. I thought you was real bees for a moment there. I like the way you flew back out of your hive."
Arvin looked pityingly at the cellar-keeper.
"That not a knive. We nor a bees what live in a knive. Us bees, that live in a wall, and dig little holes."
Furlow gave Tansy and Formal a quick glance, and began questioning the Dibbons.
"Bees what live in a wall? Don't be silly, bees don't live in walls. They'd need hammers and chisels to make nests."
Arvin shook a small grubby paw under Furlow's nose.
"Ha! Gracious me, you a big a silly beast. You know nothink.
Us'uns know bees live in a wall, don't we, Diggums?"
The mole babe nodded her head solemnly.
"Oh, yes, sir. Them our friends. He bees given Harvin a present for himself, a whole eye."
Arvin shot a warning glance at the mole maid.
"Gar, Diggums, you promise us say nothing to no beast."
Tansy leaned close to Furlow and whispered, "Did you hear that? Diggum said that a wall bee gave Arvin a present, a gift."
"Leave this to me, sir. I'll get the truth out of him."
Arvin waggled his tail in Tansy's face.
"Tansy Pansy Toogle do. More have you been telled about whisperin'? Gracious and deary, bad, bad manner it is."
The hedgehog maid caught him firmly, screwed his eyes tight shut, just to let his inquisitors know that he was going to be stubbornly silent. Formal winked at Tansy and tried his mole logic on Gerbil.
"You'm like deeper never piser."
The mole babe beamed broadly.
"I serpently do. Gert bowls it I can heat, zir."
Formal took the little fellow's paw.
"Her, you'm a growin' choild. I spec you can. Show us in the hole and wall where bee lives, and I'll give ye a deeper never pie bigger'n thyself."
With an apologetic glance at Arvin, Gerbil took them through the bushes to the southeast wall angle and pointed to a joint between the huge red sandstone blocks, only two courses up from the ground, where the mortar had crumbled.
"There be where our friend E. Bee lives, zir," he said.
Furlow picked up a twig and pushed it gently into the crack. Buzzing irately, a dusty, rust and brown-striped wallbee emerged. Furlow blew gently upon its tail, and it zipped off into the air like a pebble from a sling. Furlow probed the crack delicately with his twig, pulling forth a torn and dusty scrap of parchment. He gave it to Tansy. Spreading the tiny fragment carefully, she read aloud,
"Your search is done, the sixth pearl found. Perfect, rose-hued, pink, and round. Back home now, and a scallop shell, which I hid well and good. Tears of all oceans, truth to tell, lie stained by death and blood."
Tansy looked at Furlow.
"What do you make of that?" she said.
Tapping the wall crack with his twig, the wise hedgehog explained,
"I can guess what happened here. The wall bee came across this ere hole by accident, so she thought she'd just clean it out and use it herself. But first she had to get rid of that old pearl. And I bet the Dibbons were playing here just then,
and the bee pushed the pearl straight into Arvin's paws. "Be I right, Gerbil?" The mole babe nodded emphatically.
"Ho, Iser, Eam Buzzy Bee gave et to Harvin."
Rollo, Cracklin, and Brother Dormall were called from their search of the Abbey building, and everything was explained to them. Furlough, who was a great favorite with the Dibbons, meanwhile continued the task of making Arvin talk.
"Now then, me little mate, you can take those paws out in your ears and listen to what I've got to say."
The squirrel babe kept his ears well plugged, but opened one eye.
"I not listenin', and me not talkin', and me can't see ye."
The friendly cellar keeper merely smiled.
"Fair enough, old pal. You stay like that. I'll just chat to Diggum and Gerbil here about the feast in my cellars." "Right, you two little snips. This evening I'll let you stay up late. We'll play hide-and-seek midst the barrels. I'll rig up a seesaw, and I'll roll you round and round in a big empty barrel. Whilst we're doing that down in my wine cellars, I've no doubt Miss Tansy and her friends will make a fine feast and bring it down to us. We'll have a great party, and I'll supply the drinks, strawberry fizz, dandelion and burdock, and gooseberry cup."
Arvin unplugged his ears and opened both eyes straight away.
"We're about Arvin. Me come a party, too."
Rollo polished his glasses brusquely.
"Certainly not. Any Dibbons who hides things from his friends and carries on in such a badly behaved manner deserves only one thing: early bed and warm nettle soup."
The squirrel babe shot into the bushes and was out again in a flash, dropping the pearl into Tansy's paws. He dashed about, hugging and kissing every beast.
"I nor a bad Dibbon, see? Me a good friend. Arvin like all of you."
51. Grath Longfletch tapped her tail impatiently on the ground as she scanned the cove at midday.
"Great season's a slaughter. Here we are, all ready to go, and that long lollipin hare's gone missing. Where's he got to?
Ahoy there, you hearties, all aboard. I'm all kitted out and ready to jolly well go and do battle, what?"
Viola had to sit down laughing at the sight of Clecky perched nobly on Waveworm's prow. The hare had done a thorough search of the vessel to outfit and arm himself. He had rigged himself out in a pair of baggy red pantaloons and a tawdry cream tunic fringed with blue silk ruffles. Both his long ears flopped under the weight of massive brass rings. He carried a long piked boat hook and a javelin, and into a gaudy green waist sash he had thrust a short axe, three curved daggers, and a fearsome scimitar.
"All aboard the good ship Wave Thingy, me buckos, come on! Time and tide wait for no beast, don't you know?"
Martin turned to Grath. "Have you got everything you need?" he asked. The otter patted a pouch at her belt. "Tinder, flint, canvas, flask of lamp oil. That's all I'll need beside my bow and arrows. 2 hours before sunset, then." Martin and Inbar clasped her paws.
"Good luck and good hunting, and fates go with you."
Grath held tightly to Inbar's paw a moment longer.
"Remember what I told you, matey. Show no quarter to 'em. If they ever found your father's island, they'd slay your kin and laugh while they were slaughtering. Keep that in mind, Inbar Trueflight."
Then, releasing her friend's paw, Grath took off southwest at a fast trot. Martin and his friends boarded and got Waveworm under sail, skirting the coast northward to where the Corsair's ships lay. The 6 wave vermin who had been left to guard the disabled fleet were ashore. Well supplied with grog and food, they lounged about on the sand near the shallows, gambling with shells for trinkets. They cheated and swilled grog, throwing the shells in the air, wagering on how many would land upside down.
"My dagger says 6 on their backs, Crab's Ear."
"Taken.
I'll wager my bracelet again your blade, Cujah."
The shells fell onto the sand. Crab's Ear, the Corsair Stoat, crowed triumphantly at the sea rat Cujah.
"Only 5 upside down. Give me the dagger. I win."
"No, you don't. 'Tis 6. The dagger's still mine, mate."
"5, I say. You turned that upside down yourself, cheat."
"Cheat, is it? You slime-tongued eel. I'll give you the dagger, all right. Straighten your stinking neck."
They were about to leap on each other when Clecky appeared, wading through the shallows around the cove's edge. "Ahoy there, you unspeakable rabble! Surrender your ships, or I'll frazzle your gizzards with me frog slicer, or whatever it is you chaps say to each other, what?" Exchanging wicked smiles, the six guards rose slowly, drawing their blades as they advanced on the lone hare.
"Well, stripe me, buckos! Who in the name of barnacles is this ere popinjay?"
Whipping out his scimitar, Clucky bounded forward to meet them, slaying the speaker with a single swipe of his enormous blade.
"Stripe you? Certainly, sir. Anything to oblige. Next."
They rushed him, failing to see Martin bearing down the hill at their backs, with his sword ready for action. Around the other side of the cove, Inbar heard the cries and mounted the rail, reaching for his bow. Plog put a restraining paw on the otter.
"Best stay here, friend. Martin and Clucky'll be back shortly. There ain't no warrior in all Mossflower like Martin."
Inbar allowed himself to be pulled down to the deck.
"But what about Clucky?" he said. "There were six guards on those ships. I counted them myself."
Plog leaned back against the rail.
"Only six? Clucky could have taken them himself. Don't be fooled by that in silly talk and comical manner. As my old dad always says, hares are dangerous and perilous beasts."
The shrew's estimate was correct. It was but a short time until the two waded back around the cove, Clucky chatting animatedly.
"That vermin was cheatin', you know. Saw him myself. He tipped a seashell wrong side up with his footpaw. What a rotter. I'd hate to have that and sittin' alongside me at supper. He'd swipe all the salad whilst I had my back turned."
Martin washed his sword blade in the water and wiped it dry on his sleeve before sheathing it.
"Ha! When did you ever turn your back on a salad bowl? Any creature trying to steal food from you would starve to death."
When they had both climbed back aboard, Martin gave Welko and Viola their instructions. "Throw all the canvas, spare wood, and lamp oil into the hold of each ship. The grog, too, that's pretty flammable stuff. You've got flints and tinder enough to do the job. Wait until you see the signal. We'll pick you up as soon as we can get back here. One of you watch for our ship from the cove top. Good luck." Waveworm sailed onward, still hugging the coastline. Welko and Viola stayed with the Corsair vessels, waving to their friends until they were out of sight. Grath Longfletch had gained the highest point overlooking the Palace of Ublaz. Two trident rats lay limp close by. They had been standing sentry there when the vengeful otter visited them, silent as a leaf on the wind. Kindling a small smokeless fire in a hole she had dug, Grath sat binding oil-soaked canvas strips to four arrowheads. She had seen the exact targets where her shafts would do their work best. Ublaz Mad Eyes peered over the wall at the Wave Brethren's encampment. He did not like what he saw.
"Zurgot!" he rapped out. "Get the fire bales ready for tonight. I have a strong feeling they'll mount a major attack on us once it's dark. Rascanza's vermin haven't bothered sending any beast at us for hours. Look at them, lounging about over there doing nothing."
Zurgot turned her slow reptilian gaze upon the far encampment.
"You are right, Lord. They are zaving themselves for the battle tonight. Fire bales will burst upon them in the darkness."
Keeping his head low, the Pine Marten strode the length of the woodpile, stacked against the wall, stopping at each of the four large fire bales to inspect them. There were heaps of splintered dry wood and dead reeds, wound about with sailcloth and withered grass, liberally doused with vegetable oil. Ublaz chanced another peek at the enemy camp before turning to the monitor and saying,
"When I give the order, and only then, have your lizards lift the bales clear of my woodpile to the wall top, light them and drop them over onto the vermin. That field is as dry as tinder. The flames will race across it and engulf Rascanza's camp. If it does sufficient damage, wait again for my command. We should be able to charge around the ashes and finish them off in the confusion that will follow. But await my orders, Zurgot."
The monitor bowed after her emperor's retreating figure.
"Mighty Nez, I wait your commands."
She called sibilantly to the other reptiles guarding the walls.
"Victory will bring us lots of meat, roasted by the fires."
Dark forked tongues slithered in and out as the lizards hissed wildly. Leaning over the rail of Waveworm, Martin watched the sun start to dip towards the western horizon. Inbar checked the tension of his bowstring and said, "Grath should be starting an uproar about now." A green-flighted arrow stretched its length on Grath Longfletch's bowstring. The supple ewe arched back as her powerful paw pulled against the beeswax string. Dipping the arrowhead into the fire, she watched it burst into flame. Sighting swiftly as she brought up the bow, Grath gave an extra heave against the ewe and fired.
Zzzzt!
Like a burning comet, the shaft sped upwards, bending in a long arc, down to the palace courtyard. It struck the first fire bale, which went up with a dull whump into a blazing mass. As soon as the first arrow was in the air, Grath had another one zipping viciously from her bowstring, followed by another, and yet another. The fiery messengers sped off to find their targets. A monitor pointed with his spear, hissing, "The fire bales, the f—" and fell clutching the green-flighted arrow which had slain him. Now Grath was moving, changing position. Some arrows she sent to slay monitors, others to lay wave brethren low. The pandemonium she caused was instantaneous. Ublas came roaring into the courtyard, lashing about with a spear haft at the terrified lizards. "Pull those bales away! Tip them over the wall! Save my timber!" he yelled. The tremendous woodpile, having lain in tropical dryness for long seasons, was going up like a bonfire. Panic-stricken lizards leapt away from the inferno and cowered back against the palace, their fearful eyes glittering in the firelight. Ublas dashed to and fro like a mad beast, unable to get near his precious timber because of the pulsating heat of the flames.
"Do something! Fetch water! Pull away the bits that aren't burning! Get wet sailcloths and beat at the flames!"
He rushed about belaboring the dull-witted monitors until his spear haft broke on their thick-scaled hides. Rascanza ducked behind his canvas awning, grabbing Buckla and Deadgut as they passed.
"Send some of those trident rats. See if they can find the swab who's firing those green arrows before any more crew beasts are killed."
Baltur and Goncho wriggled up through the sand, keeping their heads low. Goncho pointed miserably at the blaze crackling high above the rear palace wall.
"Look at that, will you? There goes our chance to repair the fleet."
Rascanza did not seem unduly worried.
"Never fear, mates. As long as we got one ship that can sail, we can always bring wood to San Petra. Pretty soon that wall's going to collapse under the heat of that blaze. Then we'll march in there and drag Mad Eyes out. Muster the rest of the brethren and tell them to stand ready."
Plog jumped onto the jetty and secured Waveworm by a stern line. Martin had drifted her in backward so that they could cut and run at a moment's notice. Night was falling fast. The palace up on the escarpment silhouetted by the fire that raged behind it. Klecki noted that the harbor area was still deserted and silent. Plog watched his three friends climb down onto the jetty. "Let me go with you, Martin. I'm good with a shrew rapier." Martin pointed sternly to the ship.
"Sorry, but you know your orders. Now back aboard, and have her ready to take off like an arrow the moment you see us coming back."
Crestfallen but obedient, the young Gwasom shrew did as he was told. Before Martin, Klecki, and Inbar were halfway across the harbor area, Grath popped out from behind a tavern and joined them.
"All going according to plan, mates," she said, nodding at the fire glow. "That little lot's keeping them busy at the moment. Now for the palace."
They raced to the double wooden door at the top of a winding hill. Klecki sized it up before commenting,
"How's a chap supposed to get inside? Looks like we're stumped."
Martin located the center jamb and thrust his sword through it.
"Lend a paw here, Enbar. It's only a wooden bar across these doors holding them shut. When I give the word, lift the sword up hard."
The big otter gently ushered Martin aside and gripped the sword handle in both paws.
"Not enough room for both of us to hold this handle. Let me try."
Bracing himself squarely on the stones, Inbar bent slightly. The long muscles on his sleek back stood out as he swept the sword blade up. There was a clunk from the other side, and as Inbar pushed the doors, they creaked and opened inward. Klecki nodded in admiration.
"Good idea, that. I was about to suggest it myself, what?"
As they passed through the portals into the silent palace, Rath murmured in Klecki's brass-ringed ear, "Remember, we're searching for an abbot, not a dining room." Ublas finally saw that the timber was hopelessly lost. As he peered through the flames, he also noticed a sagging dip in the wall top. Soon the rear wall would start to crumble. Its mortar turned to dust, and its stones cracked and burst by the constant searing heat of the blaze. There was only one option left now. "Retreat into the palace," he called to his monitors. "The vermin will charge once the wall falls. Retreat, and we'll hold out there." 52. In his fevered dreams, Abbot Dural was helping to carry a table out into the orchard at Redwall Abbey. He imagined it was autumn, and a harvest feast would be laid out under the trees. The old mouse rambled on deliriously.
"Lift higher, Sister Cicely. We'll never get it out over the doorstep. What a heavy table this is. Where's every beast gone?"
A voice came through his fogged mind.
"Father Abbot, 'tis your friend Martin."
Feebly, Dural squinted one eye open.
"Ah, Martin. But which Martin are you?"
With tears in his eyes, Martin cradled his old friend's head.
"Dural, it's me, Martin."
Opening both eyes briefly, the abbot smiled.
"Yes, my son, but are you the Martin from the tapestry, or my Martin who lives at Redwall? I can't tell, you see."
The warrior mouse realized how ill the old fellow was. "I'm your friend Martin who lives at Redwall, with all our brothers and sisters. I've come to help you, Father Abbot."
Dural lifted a wizened paw and stroked Martin's face. "I knew you would. This table is so heavy, and Cicely is too small to lift it. Will you help us, please?"
Then Grath called urgently from the doorway she was guarding. "Hurry and get him out of here, mate. Some beast's coming." Viola was first to spot the glow lighting the night sky from the southwest.
"There goes the signal. Burn the ships,"
she yelled to Welko. The shrew already had a fire lit and a brazier aboard Baranka's former vessel, Freebooter. Holding 5 torches ready, he shouted back to Viola, who was descending from the hilltop.
"Hurry up, miss. Get aboard Freebooter with me."
The bank pole did as she was bidden, though slightly mystified by the odd procedure.
"We shouldn't be hanging about aboard this craft," she said. "You've got to set fire to it. What are you up to, Welko?"
The Gwasim shrew indicated the other ships.
"Those are the ones I'm going to burn, miss. They're old tubs, just like Waveworm. But this Freebooter, now this is what I call a real ship. Look at the lines of her. The beam, draft, sails. The craft's a real flyer. Nothing in all the seas could catch the spray of her wake when she's in full sail, I'll wager. We'll burn the other 5 and wait for them aboard this'un. Grath knows about ships. She'll agree with me."
Viola thrust the 5 torches into the brazier.
"I suppose you know best. Come on, we'll go to the last vessel in line and make our way back here, setting fire to each ship as we go."
Inside the palace, Martin rushed to the throne room door to help Grath. Backed by a score of monitors, Ublas was coming up the stairs. The Pine Martin had not expected any beast to be inside his palace. On seeing Martin at the stairhead, waiting with drawn sword, Ublas did a swift about-face. Pushing his way through the monitors on the staircase, he cried,
"It's only a mouse and an otter. Slay them! Charge!"
The warrior mouse knew that to conquer the palace he must first deal with its ruler. Hurling himself down the stairs, he roared,
"Redwall!"
But Ublas was gone, and Martin found himself surrounded by lizards. With battle light blazing in his eyes and a war cry on his lips, the warrior mouse swung his mighty blade on the crowded staircase. Monitors crowded upon him, pushed forward by the momentum of those behind, teeth bared, tongues flickering, hissing viciously as they sought to bring their long spears into play. The fabled blade of Redwall whirled into them, hacking, scything, and slashing through spear hafts. Grath stood quivering at the stairhead.
"Martin, come back! I can't get a clear shot with my arrows while you're down there. Fight your way back."
Clecky sailed past her and went bounding down to Martin's aid.
Eulalia!
In a flash he was back to back with the warrior mouse, and they fought their way upward together. The hare's huge scimitar matched Martin's sword blow for blow as they struck at scaly flesh, ripping claws, snapping teeth, and baleful reptilian heads. When they came within reach, Grath and Inbar hauled them up by the backs of their tunics. Martin's eyes were glazed over with a red mist of battle fury. Inbar broke the spell by shouting into his face,
"Go and take care of your father Abbot!"
From somewhere behind the monitors, Ublas could be heard bawling hoarsely,
"Charge! Rip them to bits! Charge!"
Long spears bristling, the monitors pressed up the stairs. Graf Longfletch already had a green-plumed arrow on her bowstring. She glanced coolly at Inbar Trueflight.
"Let's see how good you are with those red-feathered shafts of yours, mate. Ready?"
Though Inbar was frightened of the big lizard scrambling up the stairs toward them, he found himself suddenly pouring shaft after shaft into their ranks. He roared at the top of his lungs to match his companion's war shout, and their cries mingled.
"Ruddering! Halt Lutra!"
Clecky held up the chain that was holding the abbot fettered to the wall.
"Confounded manacle! And we haven't even got a blinkin' key to release the poor old buffer!"
Martin, still quivering for action, and in the grip of a berserk rage, gritted his teeth savagely.
"Keep your paws wide and hold that chain tighter." Srack!
The great sword flashed once through the air, its momentum causing the steel to whine like a tornado through ice. Clecky stared at the severed chain hanging from his paws.
"Great seasons of fur and famine. You don't dally about when you swing that blade, old scout. Well done, that warrior."
Rasconza had massed his vermin at the foot of a low hill. Weapons bristled around him like a field of corn.
"Come on, buckos," he cried. "Let's put Mad Eye's lights out."
A panicked screech rang out from Goncho on the hilltop.
"Fire! Fire at the cove! Some dirty scum's setting light to our fleet! Fire!"
Like a wave, the vermin turned and swept up the hill. They jabbered and clamored, pointing to the blazing red glow that lit up the night sky over the northwest inlet.
"Goncho's right, 'tis fire!"
"Aye, and it could only be the ships."
"Right, mate, there ain't nothing else that big to set up a light like that. 'Tis our fleet, right enough."
Rasconza hurried uphill, his heart sinking within him at the sight. Struggling to keep calm, he tried reassuring his crews.
"No, no, 'tis only the grass, mates. I'll wager old Crab's Ear and the others have gone to sleep full of grog, and the campfire's gone and spread a bit. 'Tis only the grass, I tell yer."
With drawn cutlass, Baltur faced the fox challengingly.
"What are you take us for? We ain't stupid, mate. An off-blind toad could see that's our ship's afire o'er there."
Buckler backed him up aggressively.
"Aye, and without ships, we ain't corsairs or sea rats no more. You carry on believing your own lies, fox. We're going to save our fleet. Who's with us?"
A mighty roar of agreement went up. Before Rasconza had a chance to say another word, the whole horde was off, whooping and yelling behind Baltur, Goncho, and Buckla, heading overland for the northwest cove. Rasconza's voice was lost in the din as he called after them,
"Come back, you fools! Can't you see we've got Mad Eyes cornered? Setting that fire was only a trick to draw us away from the palace. Come with me. We'll make the villain pay for those ships with his blood."
Finding his pleas fell upon deaf ears, Rasconza turned to find himself standing alone except for Sagatar. He glared at her.
"Why didn't you tell me Ublas was planning this? You're a captain of Trident Rats. You should have known."
Seeing the vengeful expression on Rasconza's face, Sagatar backed off, shaking her head.
"I knew naught of any such plan, believe me."
Rasconza drew his dagger, advancing angrily.
"You lie! I never should have trusted one of Mad Eyes' Trident Rats. You're a traitor and a turncoat, Sagatar. I knows your kind. You'd betray me the same way you did Ublas."
Sagatar brought up her trident, hefting it with menace.
"Keep away from me, fox. There's none more skilled with a trident than I am. I'll spit you like a fish in a barrel."
Rasconza turned as if to walk away. Then, spinning round with frightening suddenness, he hurled his knife. Sagatar stared in shock at the handle of the dagger that seemed to grow from her middle, She fell to the ground. Rascanza stood over her, chuckling. "Aha! You might be skilled with yon trident, but no beast can sling a blade like me. I never miss." Sagittar's lips moved. Rascanza leaned down to her. "What's that you say?" Still gripping her trident, Sagittar thrust it upward with a final effort. Gasping, she spoke her last words to the fox lying alongside her. "I said, I never throw my weapon away. I always keep hold of it." But it was too late for Rascanza to hear her. Martin tore down a velvet wall hanging and wrapped the abbot in it. The old mouse appeared to be sleeping contentedly since the appearance of his abbey warrior. Despite the rantings and shoutings of Ublas, the monitors had retreated around the curve of the staircase, out of arrow range. Enbar found he could scarce contain himself from trembling all over now that the action had ceased. Graf patted his shoulder. "You did well, mate. We thinned their ranks a bit." The big otter looked at his shaking paws. "I'm no good at this sort of thing. I was frightened." Graf was already creeping downstairs to retrieve some arrows. She turned to her huge, honest friend with a grin. "You were frightened? Matey, how do you think I felt when I saw those flesh-eaten monsters charging us? I couldn't keep me teeth from chattering to each other, and me paws felt like jelly. We had a good right to be frightened, I can tell you." Clecky and Martin joined them at the stairhead for a council of war. The hare was not overly optimistic. "Righto. Here's the picture, chaps. These stairs are the only way up or down, and we've got to get the jolly old abbot out of this palace and aboard the wave thingy. Any suggestions?" Graf passed a bunch of arrows to Enbar. "We don't know how many more of those lizards are waiting downstairs, and the Pine Marten's still commanding them. I can't see him letting us out of this place alive." With a swift wrench, Martin pulled down another velvet wall hanging. "There's one way. If we can get at Ublas and slay him, I don't think those lizards will have any heart left to fight. There's enough of these velvet wall trappings to make a rope. If I take Clecky with me, we could reach the ground from that window, come back into the palace, and attack them from behind. Graf and Enbar could charge down the stairs at them, and we'd have them both ways. It's a risky plan, I know. We're outnumbered 10-1. But with the element of surprise on our side, we could escape from here." Enbar had a suggestion to make. "Can we not all escape by the window, Martin?" The warrior mouse shook his head. "Too steep, rocky, and dangerous. Besides, there's the abbot. I still haven't figured how we're going to get him out." Enbar glanced over to where Dural was lying, wrapped in velvet. "I'm the strongest here. Leave him to me. We'll carry out your original plan, Martin. When I attack with Graf, I'll sling the old mouse and that velvet hanging across my back." Clecky began knotting the wall hangings together. "Righty-ho, crew. Let's get moving, what?" Aboard the freebooter, Viola and Welko had pushed off. Once away from the five burning ships, they dropped anchor in a safe position. Viola made a quick search of the vessel and emerged from the galley to announce, "Well, there's plenty of supplies aboard." Welko silenced her with a wave of his paw. "Quiet, miss. Listen. Can you hear anything?" Yelling madly, the sea rats and corsairs breasted the cove top and came pouring downhill towards the inlet. They stood in the shallows, their cries dying away into silence, faces registering horror in the ruddy glow of the firelight. Ships' timbers crackled and bellied. Sails and rigging sent off black ash smuts like dark bats to flit about in the breeze. Cascades of sparks and burning pitch shot skyward into the night. The entire scene was mirrored like a fiery portrait in the still dark waters of the cove. Gancho bellowed like a wounded beast.
"Wah! They're burning! Our ships are burning, mates!"
Throwing himself down in the shallows, he kicked and beat the water, bawling aloud like a babe in a tantrum. Buckla stepped out of the firelight as far as he could and peered into the blackness until his eyes became accustomed to it.
"Ha-ha, mates, see? There's Baranka's old craft, the freebooter, sitting out there as fancy as you please, with not a mark on her."
Pulling off his sea boots and tossing aside sword and belt, he plunged deeper into the water, shouting,
"Let's swim out to her. First beast to clap a paw aboard a freebooter,
has the right to call himself captain.
Ridding themselves of all encumbrances, sea rats and corsairs flung themselves into the water and began striking out for the ship, which was riding at anchor on the swell. Viola looked fearfully at Welko as they both crouched together behind the stern rail.
"What are we going to do now?" she asked.
53. Ublas had armed himself with a long curved saber. He stood in the palace entrance hall, brandishing it at the 40 or so monitors left from his command. Zergot came hurrying in from the rear courtyard.
"Mighty Nez, Rasganza and his vermin are gone. The rear wall has collapsed, but no beast is out there."
Ublas breathed a silent sigh of relief, then began berating the monitors who kept trying to edge away from the stairs. "You see, the wave scum probably perished in the flames trying to scale the rear wall. When we have cleared out those intruders from my throne room, the palace will once again be mine. Zergot, you will head the charge upstairs. Leave none alive. Now go."
Zergot saluted with her long spear, and bullying through the ranks of her subordinates, she mounted the stairs.
"Follow me. We will slay—"
Red and green flighted arrows struck her simultaneously.
"Roddering! Holt Lutra!"
The otter archers appeared around the stairwell, Grath slightly in front of Inbar, shielding her friend and the burden he carried. Both of them rained shafts of death at the monitors. Ublas was turning to look for a safer place to command when he saw Martin and Klecki come thundering through the main doors. There were monitors blocking his way to the rear door. Dodging swiftly to a downward flight of stairs, he sped toward the cellars. With his scimitar in one paw and a javelin in the other, Klecki pushed Martin towards the cellar stairs.
"You get after him. I'll help out here."
"I say, you chaps. Eulalia!"
The perilous hare flung himself at the back ranks of monitors, flaving his weapons like a windmill in a gale. Attacked at front and rear, the lizards fought back savagely. Regardless of wounds, Klecki battled valiantly forward, through spears, teeth, and claws, striving to cut a path to his friends on the staircase. A spear tore his ear, and he vanquished its owner with a curving downward stroke of the scimitar.
"Fall back, the foe beast! Clextar Lepus Montisle to the fray! A Montisle am I! 'Tis death to stand before me!
Particularly in line for dinner, what?
Forward the whites!"
Snatching a lighted wall torch from its bracket, Martin bounded down the cellar stairs. He raced along a short corridor, and on to another downward flight of steps. The warrior mouse paused at the bottom and held up his torch. He was in an oblong chamber with a door at its far end. Martin could tell the door was ajar by the shaft of light that streamed out into the chamber. Taking a firm grip on his sword hilt, he moved cautiously up to the door and swung it open slowly. It revealed the eeriest sight he had ever witnessed. Wearing a crown upon his head, the mad-eyed emperor was crouching in front of a snake. He was murmuring a sing-song chant as both he and the reptile swayed from side to side, their eyes locked in a frenzied stare. The small room shimmered in the golden torchlight. Everything was bathed in a radiance of gold, from the crown and the coils of the reptile to the walls, which swam in weaving patterns cast by a large stone tank of water at the back of the room. Martin watched in fascination as the snake's eyes filmed over and its head stopped moving. The serpentine body lost its threatening stiffness, and it subsided to the floor. Ublas touched the poisonous reptile's head, stroking it softly as he spoke without turning to look at his pursuer. "A coral snake is the most deadly killer in the seas. See how my power can render it harmless? No beast alive can perform such magic. Only I, Ublas, Emperor of Sampetra, ruler of all monitors and wave scum. They call me Mad Eyes, but never to my face. What do they call you?" Martin stared at Ublas's back, draped in a flowing cloak of gold.
"I am Martin, the warrior of Redwall Abbey," he said.
"Ah, yes, I should have known.
You have come to free your abbot. Did you bring my 6 pearls, the tears of all oceans?"
The warrior mouse's voice rang hard as the steel he held.
"I brought only my sword."
The emperor's voice took on a cajoling tone.
"Swords are dangerous things to bargain with, Martin.
Death is the only payment they exact. What if I told you that I am willing to let you and your friends walk free from here? I would say that you are lying, and you would try to have us slain before we got to our ship. Whilst Martin spoke, Ublas was slowly drawing the saber from his waist sash. The movement was hidden by his flowing cloak. He tensed himself to spring as he continued talking. I was not always an emperor. Once I was a corsair, the most feared sword beast of the high seas. I ruled with my blade. Martin's quick eye caught the shifting of the Pine Marten's cloak. Silently he stepped sideways and took up the warrior's stance. Ublas made his move then, roaring as he whirled about and lunged with the saber. Mine is the last name you'll hear. Ublas! Clang, clash. Martin parried the thrust and brought his blade into play. Back and forth they dodged and skipped, slashing, riposting, and countering, steel singing against steel, to provide music for the dance of death. Warrior and emperor, blade for blade, backing, weaving, their sword points seeking and questing, whirling in the flickering gold light, the Pine Martin rushed his opponent. Gripping the saber with both paws, he battered the warrior mouse into a crouch. With a swift sweep of his sword, Martin sliced across his adversary's footpaw, then bringing the blade up in a flashing arc, he fenced Ublas into a corner. The emperor bowled his way out, inflicting a gash in Martin's side. They locked blades in the center of the room, pushing sword hilt to saber guard, as each strove wildly to gain the upper paw. Panting and gasping, eye to eye, the combatants swayed, grasping for any hold their footpaws could find that might serve as a lever. Then, without warning, Ublas dropped his head to one side and bit savagely into the side of Martin's neck. With a mighty roar of pain, the warrior lashed out. His paw locked tight around the sword handle, punched Ublas solidly in the eye. The Pine Martin's mouth fell open. Colored lights exploded on his vision as he staggered backward, and trod upon the sleeping snake. Faster than any eye could follow, the venomous reptile struck, burying its fangs in the leg of Ublas. Martin stood watching, his chest heaving as he sucked in air hungrily, a paw clamped to his wounded neck. Ublas' saber clattered to the floor. He was swaying, his head drooping to one side, squinting as his vision blurred. He stared dazedly at the coral snake as it slithered across the room in a golden fluid movement. Back into its tank it slipped with hardly a ripple. The emperor took a few unsteady backward paces until he reached the wall. Then, leaning against it, he slid down into a sitting position. Stretching forth his sword, Martin picked the crown from Ublas's head with his blade tip. The thick garnet-studded circlet slid down the hilt. Martin looked down at Ublas, who was staring back at him in disbelief, his lips moving. No beast was mightier than me. Emperor, I was... Martin looped the crown onto his belt and squatted facing the dying Pine Martin. So, yours wasn't the last name I heard, but here's the last name you'll ever hear. I say it for a friend whose kin you had murdered for a half-dozen pearls. Martin brought his face closer to Ublas and roared aloud. Halt, Lutra! 54. Klecki had succeeded in fighting his way through the ranks of monitors to the stairway. He passed Grath his javelin, and gave Inbar the short axe he had thrust into his sash. The two otters shouldered their bows, and Klecki and Grath placed themselves on either side of Inbar, who still had the abbot bundled upon his back. Battling madly, they were halfway to the main entrance when Martin came charging from the cellar stairs to join them, shouting, "Mad Eyes is dead! I have slain Ublas!" There was an immediate lull in the fighting, as the monitors lowered their spears and stared dully at one another. Martin got behind Inbar to protect the abbot. "Come on, back to the ship, quick!" he yelled. Plog peered through the darkness at the huddle of creatures clattering along the jetty toward him. He drew his rapier, calling, "Who goes there?" Klecki could not resist. "Just a one-eared hare, a wounded warrior, a sleeping abbot, and a couple of plank-tailed water dogs. Youch! I say, watch it!" Grath smiled as she waggled the javelin tip. "Sorry, mate, I slipped." Plog helped haul the abbot aboard. He was still sleeping, wrapped snugly in the velvet wall hanging. The shrew glanced up towards the palace, saying, "There's about a score of lizards milling round up there. Looks as if they're wondering what to do." Martin pulled Klecky over the stern rail, then severed the rope lines holding Waveworm to the jetty. "We're not waiting to find out what they're going to do. Make sail, and let's get away from this place." Viola and Welko dashed back and forth on the deck of Freebooter. With a pair of oars they had found, the two of them were smacking every head or paw that showed over the rails. There was a moment's respite. Quivering with fear and exhaustion, the vole maid leaned wearily against the rail.
"Oh, dear. Oh, goodness me. We can't keep this up much longer. Good job they've given up for a while."
"Yeek!"
Welko ran at her, swinging his oar. He brought it down, whooshing within a hair's breadth of Viola, to crash upon the head of an evil-looking ferret, gripping a cutlass between his gapped teeth. "Don't turn your back on the rail, miss. That near add you," he said. He stared out into the flame-lit darkness. The burning ships were beginning to hiss and sizzle as they sank lower into the shallows. Welko shook his head in despair at what he saw. "They put some of that burning timber out, and they're lashing together a couple of rafts. We're in real trouble if Martin and the others don't show up soon." On the shoreline, Buckla touched the top of his head tenderly.
"I'll keel all that perishing vole maid for belting me with that oar. Make those lashings tight, mates. Aha! Let's see him try to stop us this time. Gancho, are the rafts ready?"
Gancho locked off a vine rope with two half turns and a double hitch.
"Ready as they'll ever be, bucko. Come on, we can paddle with our paws. There's no more than 10 ship lengths out to Freebooter."
Corsairs and sea rats piled aboard the two rafts until they were low in the water. Baltur licked the edge of his cutlass meaningfully.
"Yahar, keep the shrew alive. I want a little fun with him afore the fishes get what's left."
The vermin on the raft's edges began paddling with anything available. Paws, spear blades, and scraps of driftwood. Both rafts were making fair progress until about halfway. Suddenly the night-darkened waters exploded beneath them.
"Nagorama! Harawoom! Garuchur! Harm not our friends! Go from here!"
The great bull seal Hom and a pack of adult male and female seals had smashed the rafts to matchwood in seconds. Huge wet tails and strong flippers made loud thwacking noises as they rendered each vermin senseless with a single smack. Sea rats and corsairs flew out of the water and through the air to hit the sand, as the powerful mammals flung them ashore with mighty flicks of their sleek heads. Welko and Viola leaned over the rail of Freebooter, laughing gleefully at the sight.
"Ooh! King Hom gave that sea rat such a crack. Did you see him?"
"Aye. Look at that ferret. He did a somersault in the air afore he landed on shore. Go on, mates, give it to him."
"Oh, yes, please. Belt that slimy stoat good and hard for me."
King Hom swam up to the side of the ship, then clapping a flipper against his broad chest, he smiled and bowed. Welko and Viola clapped their paws together joyfully, calling aloud,
"Hom! Hom!"
The king pointed his flipper at Waveworm, rounding the cove.
"Matan! Matan!"
Dawn found a happy party taking breakfast on the foredeck of Freebooter. Grath patted the rail, saying,
"You did well to save this'n, mate. She's a beauty. Martin, what about old Waveworm there?"
Wordlessly, Martin thrust a torch into the breakfast fire. He leapt the gap between both ships, landed neatly on Waveworm's deck, and drew his sword. The sea rat Gouja screamed in terror as the blade whizzed past his head, severing the chain that tethered him to the mainmast. Martin hauled him to the side and booted him overboard.
"I give you your life," he said. "Swim for the shore, rat."
The warrior mouse set fire to the sails before pitching the torch into the hold. Leaping back aboard Freebooter, he severed the ropes holding Waveworm to its side. A loud wail of despair arose from the vermin nursing their injuries on the beach. Grath reached for her bow, but Martin stopped her. "Let them be, friend. They are marooned here for life, with no ships, no wood or trees growing. They could not even build a toy boat." Viola was sitting next to the abbot. He was awake now, sipping hot soup, still wrapped in the velvet wall hanging. The vole maid wiped Durrell's chin with the tattered hem of her apron. "They've got better than they deserve," she said. "Fruit, fish, and running water. Let them learn to farm the earth, like we do at Redwall. I'd say that we're lucky to be alive, wouldn't you, father?" Durrell sat up straight and smiled at Viola.
"I'd say we were lucky to be alive, young'un."
Clucky sniffed, helping himself to a fourth bowl of soup.
"Indeed. Well, I'd say it's jolly lucky for all here present with two ears. I lost one doing battle with the lizard thingies. I say, do you suppose a chap's ear'd grow again if he ate enough, what?"
Viola checked the hare's ear stump, shaking her head.
"No, but if you like, I could make you quite a nice ear with some of this red velvet backed with canvas. You've got enough ear left for it to fit over."
Clecky snatched a chunk of shrew bread from under Plog's nose.
"I say, what a spiffin' wheeze! But that red velvet, it'd look a bit odd on parade. A chap with a red velvet ear, what?"
Martin stifled a smile.
"It's not like you to be so picky, friend. How about if Viola makes it a decoration, a sort of bravery badge?"
Clecky's single ear stood straight up next to the wad of bandage wound round his stump.
"Top hole! I could dine out on something like that for seasons to come, what?"
He imitated a female hare's voice.
"Oh, Mr. Montissel, I do like your ear so picturesque."
"Ahem, thank you, ma'am. 'Tis an old war wound.
Pass me the salad, and I'll tell you how I jolly well came about it. There was I, surrounded by 500 monstrous reptiles, armed only with a good breakfast under my belt."
The crew of Freebooter dissolved into laughter.
"Oh, mutton, for your day."
They looked up to see the Seal King waddle aboard. He turned to Inbar and held a lengthy conversation, then stood by, head held high and both eyes closed, nobly, as befits a real Seal King. Inbar explained what he had said. The king said it is not the way of friends to desert each other, so he decided to return and help out. He is pleased your abbot is safe and well, and he and his seal folk would be honored to tow your ship to Ruddering. Martin shrugged, slightly puzzled.
"But we are going to Redwall."
Graf twanged her bowstring and shuffled her tail awkwardly.
Inbar's only told the king so far, but, you see, me and Inbar, we're going back to Ruddering to live there. Sorry for not letting you know sooner, Martin."
The warrior mouse seized both Otter's paws in delight.
"This is the most excellent news. May your seasons be long together with all the happiness that fortune sends you both."
Congratulations were given all round to Graf and Inbar. In his strange seal language, the Halm barked out the good news to his seal folk, who somersaulted in the water, flapping and clapping their flippers in celebration. Then Martin asked Inbar to translate a message to the Halm. "Tell His Majesty we will be pleased for him and his seals to accompany our ship to Ruddering straight away." Inbar passed on Martin's information, conversing a while with the Halm before turning back to the warrior mouse, who was holding a short conference with the abbot. "Martin," Inbar said, "our friend the Halm says that he will be honored to conduct your ship to within sight of Mossflower Country when you leave Ruddering. He knows secret routes and fast currents that can have you back home in half the time it would take any land beast to navigate that distance." Halm bowed regally, slapping the deck hard with an enormous flipper, and gesturing at the seas in a wide arc to confirm the truth of Inbar's words. Martin and the abbot approached him, Inbar translating Martin's words as he proclaimed,
"Halm, truly you are king of all seal folk. Please accept this gift from the Father Abbot of Redwall Abbey."
Unlooping the crown of Ublas from his belt, Martin passed it to Durrell, who, with quiet dignity, placed it upon the Halm's head. The king clambered up onto the forepeak, wearing the heavy gold ring that had once graced the head of the tyrannical Ublas. There was a moment's silence. Then the crew joined voices with the seal folk massed about the ship.
"Halm! Many a hoo-day! Halm!"
Wearing his new crown like a true king, Halm did a sleek dive from forepeak to sea. He vanished beneath the waves, to emerge in a rush of water, balancing the crown upon his nose, much to the amusement of every beast present. Lines were thrown out amidships and forward. Then, with a single slash of his sword, Martin severed the anchor cable, as Clecky stood by, shouting, "I rename this vessel Sea King. May her cooking fires be always lit, and the whole jolly crew well fed. Set a course for ruddering, and then head down for home, my beauties." Flog and Welko had found an old attack drum in the hold. They beat on it with ladles and broke out into a gossam voyaging song. "Let the birds fly high before us, and our wake trail straight behind. When your heart is yearning for it, home is not too hard to find. May our way be bright and sunny, back to where the campfires burn. There our friends and families waitin' for the warriors to return. Are the old ones happily livin', and the young ones tall and grown? We will soon see smilin' faces of all those we've always known. Far we've traveled, long we've wandered, morn till night and dusk to dawn, but there's no place we'll rest easy save the land where we were born." Martin leaned over the stern rail with Viola and the abbot, watching the tropical island of San Petra fade into the distance. Its inhabitants, the strange lizards, sea rats, and corsairs, were marooned, left to fight and scheme among themselves, whilst their dead emperor, Ublas Mad-Eyes, lay stripped of his crown and a dark cellar, with a poisonous snake to guard his eternal sleep. Plumes of black smoke still smudged the azure-blue sky from behind the palace and from the north cove. Tears flowed openly down Viola's face as she listened to the shrew's song. Abbot Durrell gave her his wide sleeve to dry her eyes. "Hush, little maid. Think of the autumn harvest in Redwall Abbey. You'll be there with your friends to help gather it." The vole maid wiped her face and smiled. "I'll never leave there again, as long as I live, father." 55. Summer trailed off in glory as the season turned to autumn. Misted mornings gave way to mild days, shortened by scarlet sunsets and nights lit by harvest moons. Trees wore brown-gold leafy finery, promising the earth a fine crisp carpet of russet, which would whisper wistful messages as it shifted on the gentle breeze. It was the time when Tansy was visited in her dreams by Martin the Warrior of old. Dawn light filtered softly across the dormitory as she awoke with his message clear in her mind. "Haste to the shore, look to the main, be not beset by fears. Wait faithfully for a sea king there, and take with you 6 tears. No creature within the abbey walls was more eager or determined to carry out the warrior's bidding than Tansy. In the space of 3 days she had organized everything and made the journey. Alma had given Tansy permission to take a small party with her and erect a marquee on the beach. However, the badger mother had insisted that Skipper and his otter crew, including Rangipaw and her searchers, in company with Logalog and the Gwasam Shrews, accompany the little expedition as bodyguards. Logalog led them to the place where Waveworm had left Mossflower's shore, and a camp was set up. Tansy took with her Cracklin, Rollo, Gerrell, and Friar Higgle, and much against the badger mother's better judgment, but after great persuasion by the hedgehog maid, Arvin, Diggum, and Gerbol. The Dibbons were thrilled by their first visit to the seaside, and promptly got into all kinds of mischief. Rollo sat atop a rocky outcrop close to the tent, with Tansy and Cracklin at his side. Their eyes ached with 2 days of staring out to sea. The old recorder polished his spectacles, drowsy in the noontide warmth. "Are you sure that's what Martin said in your dream, miss? Wait faithfully for a sea king there?" he asked. "What's a sea king?" Tansy held the 6 pearls in their scallop-shell case on her lap. "I haven't a clue. Sounds pretty fearsome, though, doesn't it? What do you think this sea king'll look like, Cracklin?" "Well, my guess is that it's some kind of fearsome monster, just like those lizards who came with the sea rats. The sea king probably has Abbot Durrell and Viola with him. That's why Martin told you to take the pearls along, to ransom them both back from the sea king." Tansy's eyes strayed to a rock pool where the Dibbons were playing. "Hum, that makes sense. I never thought of it like that.
"Arvin, come here, you little maggot, and show me what you've got there."
The little squirrel and the two mole babes carried a wooden shrew soup bowl carefully, water slopping over its edges. Approaching the rock where the friends were seated, Arvin peered villainously up at them, holding the bowl up.
"Whoo, Tansy Pansy, we're gar a little spider. What swims in a water? And he gonna jump up and bite you noses off?"
Rollo peered down at the tiniest crab he had ever seen, no bigger than a little apple pip. It scrambled sideways under water, holding up two claws that were almost invisible to the naked eye. The recorder looked severely over his glasses at the giggling trio.
"That's no spider. It's a baby crab, and somewhere in that pool it has a mother and father as big as I am. No, bigger. If you don't put their baby straight back into the pool, they'll be out here in a moment and have you three for dinner."
"Grr, you do say, sir? Pull him back, ye little crab spider, Harbin, quick-like. I bain't gittin' headed up by that 'un's mum and daddy."
They fled, squealing, to empty the bowl back into the pool. Tansy returned her gaze to the horizon of endlessly shifting sea. She stared westward and pondered, "I wonder what happened to Martin and the others. I hope the Sea King hasn't harmed them. Maybe we'll be able to use the pearls and strike a bargain that'll get them all returned to us." Geralt wandered over, munching on a hot shrew cake. "Sure, and I know how to get me old mate Clecky back here. Just keep good victuals cooking. That great gut tub would smell 'em from 100 leagues off, so he would." "Aye, and those two sons of mine," Logalog called over from the cooking fire. "They'd follow their noses down to the gates of Dark Forest, if and they thought they'd find a free feed there." Skipper looked up from some hot root soup he was stirring. "Let's hope none of our friends has found their way to Dark Forest gates," he said. A respectful silence fell over all beasts who had heard the Otter Chieftain's words. Night fell over the encampment. Skipper gathered the snoring Dibbons up from their remnants of supper and their broken sandcastles, carried them into the marquee, and deposited them gently on a heap of dry rushes. Smiling fondly, he watched the Abbey babe snuggle down, still asleep, but giggling and snuffling as they settled. Rollo was deep in slumber, and Cracklin was sitting with the shrew and otter crews, singing ballads and ditties. Skipper hauled himself up onto the rock, where Tansy was still seated, watching westward over the nighttime seas.
"Ahoy, miss! Ruinin' your eyesight ain't going to get no Sea King here a moment sooner than he's due to arrive, believe me."
Tansy rubbed the back of the scallop shell case with her paw.
"I know, Skip, but I feel as if it's my responsibility somehow.
I'd hate to think of the Abbot and Viola arriving here by night in the clutches of a foe beast, with not a friendly face to greet them. It wouldn't be right, would it?"
The Otter Chieftain nodded.
"I know what you mean, young'un. But you go off and get your rest now. I'll watch a while, then post some others later. If anything gets sighted, I'll wake you myself."
Thanking the kindly otter, Tansy went into the marquee and lay down alongside the three Dibbons. Outside she could hear the restless waves breaking on the shore. Flickering firelight shadows against the tent wall reflected the creatures sitting around the fire outside. She fell asleep to the sound of Cracklin joining the shrews and otters in an old woodland ballad. "Shrum, shrum, doubledy-dum, rivers may flow, but the streams they do run, kissing the willows that droop sad and low, through sunlight and shadow as onward they go. Shrum, shrum, fie upon thee, your rivers and streams that flow down to the sea, I sit by your banks through the long weary day, to mourn for my true love who you bore away. Shrum, shrum, cruel is fate, how long must I linger by water and wait? You babble round rock, and you swirl around stone, and share your dark secrets with none but your own. Shrum, shrum, tears may fall. I'm bound for the place where the lone seabirds call. I'll build me a boat and sail down to the sea. There I'll search for the heart that is dearest to me. Shrum, shrum, shrum." In her dreams, Tansy was again visited by the ancient spirit of Martin. This time he had only one thing to say. "The abbess will know what to do with the pearls." Morning light found a breezeless day, with heavy mist wreathing the shoreline. Every beast was up bright and early to help with the day's chores. Tansy and Cracklin took the dibbins along the tide line, gathering driftwood for the fire. It was a strange, subdued sort of day. Even the Abbey babes seemed quieter than usual. Tansy and Cracklin kept an eye on the little ones as they looped a rope around the bundle they had gathered. Only the gentle lap of waves against the sand broke the silence where they stood, hemmed in by mist shrouds. Suddenly Tansy felt an odd compulsion stir within her. She turned to face seaward, staring into the mist. Cracklin and the Dibbins turned with her. Arvin sounded rather fearful as he tugged her tunic hem.
"Tansy, what a matter? Something out there?"
A great shining dark monster, dripping water and wearing a gold crown upon its head, came shuffling out of the sea, dragging in its jaws a thick rope. Casting aside the rope, the beast threw back its massively sleek head and roared,
"Home!"
As Cracklin and the three Dibbins clung to her, Tansy could hear herself shouting aloud,
"Help! The Sea King! Help! Help!"
Then the beach was alive with dark, shining creatures of all sizes, from fully grown to little ones, all roaring as they flung ropes in the air.
"Home! Home!"
Armed with javelin and rapier, Skipper and Logalog came bounding through the mist. However, they skidded to a stunned halt when a dark, mountainous object rode through the fog on a wave and ground to a halt, plowed deep into the tide-lined sands. Two figures slid expertly down ropes onto the beach.
"Sorry we couldn't find no walking sticks for you, old feller."
Throwing his paws around his two sons, Logalog swept them clear of the ground, hugging them fiercely.
"Har, har, you scraggy-headed rips. Sneak up on your old daddy like that, would you? Your barnacle-whiskered pups, welcome back. You must have smelled breakfast a-cookin'."
The Sea King had come home to Mossflower Country. End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.